Hello and welcome to Endnotes, a WooCast production. In this series, we take you behind the cover and through the pages of books on politics, policy, and more, all written by faculty at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. I'm Rose Huber, and joining me today is Melissa Lee, an assistant professor of politics and international affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School. Melissa specializes in the international and domestic politics of state building and state capacity. Today, we're going to be discussing her new book, Crippling Leviathan, How Foreign Subversion Weakens the State, published by Cornell University Press. Welcome to the show, Melissa.
It's great to be here, Rose.
You know, it's really great to see the completion of this book because I remember now several years ago when it kind of started as an academic paper that I wrote about, actually, and I remember you saying you were working on it. So maybe you could give us a little background on what motivated you to turn this into a book and why now.
Well, I began this project because I was curious about why seemingly capable countries don't govern parts of their territory. There are places where the state is simply absent, and where there are no services, where government agents can't go. And so I wanted to know, why do these places exist? You know, the existing scholarship in political science emphasizes factors that increase the costs of exercising state authority. These are things like mountainous terrain or distance from the capital or resistant populations. All of these things should make it harder and more expensive for central authorities to govern. And I didn't think that those explanations were wrong per se, but I did think that focusing only on domestic factors missed a big part of the story, which is the international side. And that's what Crippling Leviathan is about, how foreign governments deconsolidate the state.
So in the book, it seems as if you're arguing that enemy governments sort of empower insurgents to destabilize a particular country, sort of creating this ungoverned territory. And then these actors can use this to their advantage. Did I get that about right?
Yes, that's exactly it. In the book, I call this practice foreign subversion. The disruption and destabilization that results is politically valuable. It can distract target states. It could force them to spend time and money dealing with problems that they wouldn't otherwise face. It could deny them access to valuable natural resources. And it can be used to create bargaining leverage, in which the enemy state extracts policy concessions in return for its help in solving the problem that the enemy state created. It's kind of like foreign policy racketeering, and it works.
You know, I just want to jump in for a second because when I first started doing work in your area, the term state was always throwing me off. So I just want our listeners to know that by state, we mean just a country, right? A territory.
Right.
Okay.
Just
throwing that in there. So back to what you just said, what effects does this have on the governance of a state? Maybe you can explain how they go about doing this and give us some examples of this racketeering you're talking about.
Foreign subversion disrupts state authority on the ground. The exercise of state authority is the exercise of government power. It's the enforcement of rules and regulations, the provision of services, the maintenance of security, law and order, and the levying of taxes. Now, the world's very early states did almost nothing in terms of administration other than raise taxes and occasionally conscript soldiers for war. But today's states are expected to do a lot more, and they're expected to do so evenly throughout their territories, serving their entire population. And foreign subversion makes this business of government much harder, and in some cases virtually impossible. Enemy states empower local proxies by sheltering them on foreign territory, funding them with foreign resources, equipping them with arms, and training them, not just for warfare, but to become state administrators in their own rights, over their own territories. These proxies then undermine governance in the target state. For them, the first step is to dislodge local state authorities and eliminate local state presence. So that means destroying key infrastructure like government offices and roads, and it also means getting rid of the local bureaucrats, killing them or intimidating them from coming into work. But I want to emphasize that this violence is usually a means to an end and not the end itself. The local groups that become proxies for foreign actors are effective because they want to be governors themselves. They want to be state authorities. So they set up their own institutions and they act like quasi-states. So consider the example of the PKK, which is a terrorist group in southeastern Turkey that had tacit support from neighboring Syria in the 1990s. This group set up its own tax administration in the southeast part of the country. And what they did was they gathered agricultural production information so that they could assess tax burdens in a rational way, and then went out and actually levied the taxes. Another example comes from Abkhazia, an unrecognized republic in the country of Georgia. Abkhazia owes its existence to Russian support. Russia trained the administrators that run the government of Abkhazia and provides significant financial resources as well as diplomatic recognition. Abkhazia has its own currency, issues its own passports, and stood up its own military. Meanwhile, the Georgian state can't even enter Abkhazia, even though Abkhazia remains juridically part of the country of Georgia. And I think these examples illustrate two important points. So first is that although places like Southeast Turkey and Abkhazia were not governed by the central state, they're not literally ungoverned, right? They are governed, but they're just not governed by central state authorities. And the second point is that the territorial deconsolidation that's happening in these two places and the replacement of central state authority with these alternative governance arrangements is limited in the sense that it's only happening in part of the country and not all over. And that's part of what I think makes foreign subversion so interesting as a tool of statecraft. You only need to destabilize part of a country as opposed to the whole.
That's interesting. You know, I didn't really know that any of this was going on. And so I'm curious how long these subversion tactics have been being implemented by states.
There was a lot of subversion actually happening during the Cold War, although we didn't really call it that back then. And this was happening in part because a hot war between nuclear states would have been so devastating. But I want to emphasize that subversion is not exclusive to the superpowers. And to demonstrate that, the book spends two chapters tracing the effects of foreign subversion between two pairs of non-great powers: Malaysia's subversion of the Philippines in the late 1960s and early 1970s, and Thailand's subversion of Vietnamese-occupied Cambodia in the 1980s. And there was also quite a bit of subversion going on in Africa and the Middle East as well. This kind of statecraft is not exclusive to the Cold War either. Think about Pakistan's support for the Afghan Taliban, or Russian support for Abkhazia and South Ossetia and Georgia. What we're seeing today, though, is a bit different from the Cold War in at least two respects. So first, technology makes it easier and cheaper to engage in subversion. This means that more states can actually do it if they're willing proxy groups on the ground, especially because physical proximity to the proxies is less of a barrier than it was in the past. The second interesting development is that the goals of foreign subversion seem to have changed. In the Cold War, states were much more focused on regime change than territorial deconsolidation. And I think that's less true today. The goal now is to disrupt rather than to overthrow, and to divide rather than conquer.
So are you saying that what we're seeing today is sort of a new form of modern warfare?
Definitely. Many scholars have argued that from a long-term or long-run perspective, the world has been getting more peaceful, and that war between states is less frequent, less intense, and less deadly. But war, understood as the use of force, is a means for pursuing your interests. And those interests haven't gone away. Conflict hasn't gone away. Rather, it's merely adopted the guise of subversion. So states don't need to occupy someone else's territory or conquer another state to get what they want. They can use proxies to undermine governance instead. That's foreign subversion.
Got it. You know, it might be helpful for our listeners to get sort of a crash course in the conventional state building, especially as it seems like your work is challenging that. So what used to be typical, and how does subversion change what we know about traditional state building?
The baseline for the scholarship on state building is the early modern European experience. War was pretty common back then, and losing a war meant that you got wiped off the map. So for that reason, European rulers faced strong pressures to build up their bureaucracies and defend their outlying territories as a first line of defense against enemy states. Charles Tilly, perhaps the most famous scholar of state building, summarized this process by saying that war made the state and the state made war. We no longer live in a world and with a constant threat of European-style warfare, and that's a good thing. But some scholars have argued that the relatively safe international environment today means that the pressures to strengthen and consolidate states have gone away. But if we understand subversion as war by other means, then what we're actually seeing is war undermining a key aspect of state development, which is the extension of state authority throughout the entirety of a state's territory. Subversion undermines governance, and that means that more conflict is not going to build stronger states.
I think you've gotten into this a little bit already, but since we are a policy school, we always ask, does the book provide any direct policy implications or recommendations?
The book pushes policymakers to see foreign subversion as an attractive alternative to conventional force. This kind of gray zone warfare is going to be a part of the foreign policy landscape for the foreseeable future. So policymakers have three options for responding to this threat. One of those options is to reduce the external sponsor state's motive for engaging in subversion, by which I mean trying to resolve the underlying policy disputes between the sponsor state and the target state. In reality, however, there are few examples of third parties successfully settling the kinds of intractable disputes that motivate the use of subversion. So a second option is to deprive sponsors of the means of subversion by addressing the grievances that make potential proxies open to cooperation with external sponsors. This may be possible in some cases, but I'm pretty skeptical about the feasibility of this option. And so instead, the focus should be on a third option, which is increasing the costs of subversion. Policymakers have to learn how to recognize subversion when it occurs, to discriminate between legitimate and illegitimate uses of external support, and they have to be willing to impose steep punishments on states that try to weaken other states via subversion.
It's really helpful. I'm curious too about just your personal process of writing a book like this. This is just so much information jam-packed into these pages. How long did it take you to put this together? And we always like to ask this kind of fun question, what was the hardest chapter or section for you to draft?
So research always evolves. So I guess it depends on when you start counting. If you count from the very original idea all the way to the public release, that's about 10 years. But if you count from the project in its current form to now, that's about 3.
Still a long time, either
it's
way.
Still a long time, for sure. And it feels long when you're working on it.
Yeah, I bet.
One of the hardest parts, I think, for me was grappling with the normative implications of the book. Crippling Leviathan explains why states don't govern parts of their territory. And so it's an empirical study that tries to explain why the world is the way it is. It's not a normative study about how the world should be. But I found through the writing process that the normative implications were inescapable. And in the end, recognizing that state authority matters is not to ignore the fact that states that are strong enough to govern and protect and provide are also strong enough to abuse and oppress and exploit. Many of today's consolidated states have used state power to advance human welfare. But the historical process of becoming a consolidated state was often pretty violent. So I don't advocate for state building as a policy for the West. State building as a policy has to incorporate political and normative concerns, including an assessment about its feasibilities and the obstacles to its success. And Crippling Leviathan is about those obstacles.
You know, the title of the book is also pretty compelling. I know Leviathan is a word used on your summer softball team, so I know it's a political term. Can you tell us a little bit more about the inspiration behind the title?
Yeah, so I wanted a title that would capture the idea that foreign subversion inflicts damage on states in ways that are fundamentally different to the old style of warfare that built European states. You know, one of my favorite books about that old style of warfare is by Professor Tanisha Fazal, and it's titled State Death. It's really an evocative title.
Yeah.
States used to die, but now they don't. They just get weak. And so Crippling Leviathan as a title is meant to evoke that image, with Leviathan being the state itself. So the state, the Leviathan, it continues to exist. But the state doesn't work and it doesn't govern in some parts of its territory. So it's crippled. It's not dead. It's just
Got
weak.
Got it. So who's the target audience in mind for the book? Who should add this to their reading list during quarantine?
So I think there's two sets of communities that are going to find this book interesting. So on the policy side, policymakers and practitioners who work in the security, intelligence, and development communities are going to find the ideas both provocative and timely. And this is a book about foreign subversion aimed at territorial deconsolidation, but it's lessons about subversion as an instrument of statecraft and as a tool of modern war can be applied to non-territorial forms of disruption. Think about Russia's electoral interference, for example. So from a policy standpoint, it does have broader relevance. Now, on the academic side, I think scholars and students in political science, sociology, and economics who want to understand the contemporary politics of state building are also going to find the book valuable. This book challenges us to confront the problem of state weakness through an international lens and to rethink what it really means to be a weak state.
Well, Melissa, I think we're just about out of time, but is there anything else you want to add about the book before we wrap up?
I think one of the coolest features of the book is its data on state authority. When I started this project 10 years ago, there really was no systematic data to measure state authority for a large number of countries. That was a real barrier to studying territorial state consolidation and state weakness. The data had to be built from the ground up. But now that it exists, and now that it's been released publicly, other scholars can use this data to push the research frontier on state building and state capacity. And as a scholar who works on these kind of topics, I think that's really exciting.
Yeah, I think that's really, really amazing. Crippling Leviathan is available now through Cornell University Press, Amazon, and in bookstores across the country. Thank you so much again for joining us today, Melissa. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me, Rose.
We want to thank our listeners for tuning into EndNotes, currently available on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. This show is edited and produced by me, Rose, and usually recorded by our audio engineer, Dan Kearns, but today's episode was done entirely remotely. We also want to thank our visual designer, Egan Jimenez. Take care, everybody. You've been listening to EndNotes, a series produced by WUCAST, the podcast enterprise of Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. The content you've just heard does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School.